It's extraordinary, Bill. I've known you now for 5 years, 4 or 5 years, I think, and I've heard you tell that story on 5 or 6 occasions, and it loses none of its power to shock and move hearing it. Can I ask you a question about the most recent moves that have been made in the United States? So we knew all about the Vesonitsky and attempts. Why has the latest move happened now? Because it's 7 oligarchs, 12 companies, 17 senior government officials. Why has that happened now within the last couple of weeks? I mean, do you detect that that's something that has come from the top, from Trump? Because that sounds sort of improbable.
The whole thing is very confusing Trump today has decided he supports the Trans-Pacific Partnership. this is what he pulled out of, if you remember. I mean, there's no logic. So what I can say, and I can say this very clearly, unequivocally, is that the Trump administration, not Donald Trump, but his administration, the U.S. government as it stands right now, is much tougher than the Obama administration was on Russia. It consists of Jim Mattis, the defense secretary, Pompeo, who's head of the CIA and about to become the Secretary of State, is tougher on Russia than anything I've ever heard from any Secretary of State before. Nikki Haley, if you watch any of her speeches at the United Nations, says it how it is. And they've supplied offensive weapons to Ukraine. They've added high value names to the Magnitsky list in December. They added the son of the general prosecutor of Russia to the Magnitsky list in December. And they did this thing last week. One cannot understate how tectonic sanctioning main Russian oligarchs is. You know, when they were putting on generals after they invaded Ukraine, those generals, you know, it's inconvenient, it's kind of annoying, maybe whatever. But putting Oleg Deripaska on the sanctions list is just, I mean, it's just absolute sort of the most powerful thing that could be done. And why is that? Because basically, if you are a multinational businessman and you're on the U.S. sanctions list, every bank will close your account. Every company will cancel their contracts. You know, maybe a Chinese company won't, but any company anywhere else will. And as a result, the stock price went down 50%. And I think it probably should go down more because it's impossible to be a sanctioned company. Okay.
So the next question is, what is there for Mueller to find?
Well, I mean, it's ridiculous for us to sit in our armchairs prognosticating about what he's going to find.
You're more likely to know what he's likely to find than most of us here.
Who knows what he's going to find? Who knows what's prosecutable? I mean, Mueller has got, he literally has 1,000 times the resources that any of us do to know what's going on. He's wiretapped, he's subpoenaed, he's bullied.
Has he interviewed you?
I can't say, but okay. He's got the resources, and he will find either there was collusion or there wasn't collusion. Either there was obstruction that's provable, or there wasn't, and we'll find out. I mean, it must be pretty scary to be Donald Trump. I mean, he's got 20 of the best U.S. attorneys in the country. A U.S. attorney is like one of these very powerful lawmen, and underneath those 20 U.S. attorneys, he's got 200 FBI agents. It must be terrifying for Trump if he's done anything that's prosecutable, because they'll find it out.
I remember interviewing Rudy Giuliani on the day that he sent Boesky down, and I went into his office, and his feet were up on the desk, and he had his cigar on, and he was a frightening individual, and you wouldn't want to come up against somebody who had that degree of power. Let's go backwards a bit. Can we do some what-ifs? What, in your opinion, could have happened post Yeltsin that would have led to a better outcome for Russia than where they are now?
Well, if Putin was a different person, if he wasn't a criminal, there's a famous Russian expression, the fish rots from the head. And Putin is a crook, and he set up an entirely well-organized criminal regime. And there's really no there was no way it wouldn't have gone horribly. It's just a question of how horribly it went and how quickly it went horribly. I mean, I always said to myself, so Putin was running a kleptocracy. I mean, instead of having 22 oligarchs, he wanted to be the oligarch himself. And I always said to myself, I don't see how this is sustainable. How is it sustainable if 150 million people live in poverty and 1,000 people get all the money? And those people, in theory, vote. And I said to myself, there's no ideology here. You know, you can impoverish people if you get them whipped up into a frenzy over a religion or over some type of ideology. The communists did it. The Iranians do it with their religion. But there was no ideology. And I thought to myself, how is this going to work? And the answer is, if you have no ideology and you're stealing everything from everybody, they're going to get grumpy eventually. And they did. And they started going out into the streets. And they went out into the streets, and Putin said, oh my God, this could really be bad for me. And so what do you do if you're a leader and you're worried about, you have no ideology and you're worried about your people turning on you? You take out Machiavelli's handbook and go to the first chapter and start a war. You start a war and you create a nationalistic frenzy, and that's what they did with Ukraine. And then that's what they've done with Syria. And at the same time as you do that, you repress the hell out of everybody in your country by arresting all the opposition leaders, poisoning a few people, killing a few people abroad. That always helps. And so you get everyone scared and you get everybody in a nationalistic fervor, and then you stay in power. And the trouble is that the economy is not getting better, it's getting worse. And as it gets worse, people are grumbling even more. And so you've got to continue to stir the pot. And so we're not going to see anything but more dangerous behavior on the part of Vladimir Putin.
So to go to what's been happening in the last couple of days and Zuckerberg in Washington, what, if anything, do you think that those social media companies are guilty of when it comes to interference with the democratic process, not only in the United States, but also potentially here in Europe?
Well, I think that they're completely guilty of creating a massive distortion in U.S. public opinion and British public opinion and various other public opinion about different issues, that certain people are smarter about abusing than others. And I kind of view Facebook like BP. You know, BP spilled a bunch of oil in the Gulf of Mexico and they had to pay for it because they wanted to profit out of that oil. Facebook is profiting out of people's private data, and they sold it to people who then abused it, and they should face a financial fine for doing that. And by doing so, that would probably stop. They're smart enough to create their own filter so it doesn't do that going forward.
But do you believe that an organization like Facebook actually had a definite influence in putting Trump into power and potentially over the referendum on EU membership here?
Yeah, in America, Trump won by 77,000 votes in a country of 380 million people. Well, it doesn't take much, you know, I was kind of feeling a little angry towards Hillary Clinton, and I'm an, you know, a sophisticated person. You know, it has an effect on everybody.
So looking at Putin and Trump, what do you think is gone wrong then in the kind of quality of leaders that we appear to have been throwing up in countries like Russia and America over recent years?
Well, I mean, it's Putin basically he's not a legitimate president of Russia. This is all illegitimate at this point. There's nothing wrong with what's wrong is he's completely cheated. With Trump, I mean, I think that there was a problem, and there's a problem everywhere where people were not being served by their governments, and so there's a lot of anger. And it's interesting because in France, so everybody who was an outsider became head of state, or in that. So in the case of France, Macron was the outsider. The fascist was the long-term insider, and so she didn't get elected. But the fresh-faced guy who was like not even 40 became the president, and so I think it's more a question of people just frustrated with how their governments are everywhere, and of course that was also exacerbated by all the social media and these echo chambers, et cetera.
Where are you currently then on capitalism as the best way forward for the common good in post-dictatorial and developing countries? Because when we've spoken about this before, I've always had the sense that you still believe in it as the solution.
Well, you can't have communism because that doesn't work. Capitalism doesn't work either if you don't have a rule of law, if you don't have property rights, and you don't have regulation. And so capitalism needs to be tempered by, you know, rules to prevent people from... Anyone who's maximizing profit, who doesn't care about laws, who doesn't care about, you know, who can kill... I mean, there's lots of things. You can maximize a lot of profit by killing everybody. And those things are tolerated in certain places and not tolerated in others. I mean, in a well-regulated, organized system, capitalism can work. It doesn't work if there's no laws.
Right. Now, there's a question I'm sure we all would like an answer to from you. Did you watch Mafia?
Of course. How can I not?
And what did you make of it?
Well, they came to me actually when they were writing it, and I spent a couple afternoons with them. Giving them descriptions of how real Russian officials and gangsters and others, I thought it was pretty realistic. The one big failing of McMafia is that they drew a distinction between the mafia and the government, and there is no in Russia, the two are absolutely merged. And it's very hard for anyone to even imagine that that's possible. And I've always had to correct everybody that is what happened. So when Red Notice movie comes out, we're going to fix that problem.
So tell us about that, because the last time I spoke to you, you'd taken over the writing of the script yourself. Are you still doing that?
Well, so I figured out why it was so hard to write the script, because I spent like 2 years working on it. And that is because you only have 1 hour and 45 minutes to tell a story. And I have so much to say that it was almost impossible for me to figure out what I wanted to get rid of and what I wanted to keep. And I kept on keeping too much. And every time I write a script, and I've been many drafts, it was always didn't quite work. And so I made this huge strategic decision a couple weeks ago, which is that if I can't fit it all into 1 hour and 45 minutes, I either am going to have to narrow it down dramatically, which I didn't want to do, or I'm going to have to take... I need a lot more time. But thankfully, we're in the world where miniseries now are the new way in which people watch these things. And so we're going to... I've completely changed directions, and we're going to make a miniseries.
Wow. And when will that go into production?
Well, hopefully... I'm going to go to Hollywood soon to sign up one of the big companies to do it with, and then... Hopefully it happens quickly after that. I've got a big problem, though, which is that Dwayne The Rock Johnson, you guys know The Rock? You've seen that guy? This guy announced that he's going to do a big comedy action film called Red Notice. And so I've got to beat him to market.
Well, good luck with that. So what do you advocate currently is the best way to counter Putin then?
Well, I mean,
what have we got to do in the West?
They figured it out last week. Go after the oligarchs. I swear to God, Putin... So Putin is a guy who understands boundaries when you show him boundaries. And we need we showed him a real boundary. And he's going to think twice about doing really offensive stuff because... we've only sanctioned 7 oligarchs so far, and there's 200 on the U.S. list, and more can be sanctioned. And I guarantee you, it's not going to be obvious. The rhetoric is always going to be ugly. But the actions are not going to be as ugly going forward because he's scared now.
But is there a chance that they might turn on him then, or not?
No, he controls them. You know, he can arrest or kill them at any moment in time. They're not going to turn on him. But it's his money. He holds money through all these guys. And that's why this is so devastating.
I remember when we spoke before, we kind of likened him to Macbeth. I'm in blood stepped in so far that should I wade no more, returning were as tedious as Goa. And he is like that, isn't he? I mean, he...
No way out.
He can't go backwards.
There's no way out. He's stuck. There's no way that Putin will ever step down. People always say, well, you know, this is his last term or whatever, and, you know, it's ridiculous. I mean, he can make up terms, he can change the rules, he can do whatever he wants, and they will. They will change the rules. He will stay in power until he's either dies of natural causes, is deposed, or killed by somebody.
Okay. Now, I can't let you go without asking you about what's happened in Salisbury in the last couple of months. What do you think has been going on there?
Well, nothing until the poisoning.
Yeah.
You've been to
Salisbury. Nice city.
Why did the Russian government poison Sergei Skripal in Salisbury? It has nothing to do with the UK, and it has nothing to do with Skripal. They needed to poison somebody in a Western country to punish or to show every person who's considering disloyalty that if you're disloyal, we will track you down anywhere you are in the world, and we will kill you, and we will kill your family. And that was the message that they needed to send to all the high-ranking secret policemen and interior ministry officers and generals, because they don't have an ideology. There's no Putin regime ideology. And the way that they kept loyalty before was by money. But the pot of money is shrinking. The economy is not so good, and the people who have the biggest power are taking bigger shares of the money for themselves. And so a lot of people just aren't getting the money, and so the incentives aren't there for them to behave. And so he's got to create a fantastic disincentive against misbehavior. And the Sergei Skripal poisoning did just that.
So you just think they picked him at random, really?
Well, maybe they picked him because he fit a good... it's a good demographic, you know, a guy who... A traitor, a true traitor, who left supposedly all forgiven. And that's another part of the message. We don't ever forgive and we don't ever forget. I don't know exactly what's going through their minds, but I know the message that they wanted to send.
When something like that happens, what do you feel about yourself and your own position then?
Well, my main task post-Salisbury was to publicly shame the government for not doing anything after Litvinenko, to basically blame them for, you know, if you have an act of nuclear terror against a British citizen in 2006 in Mayfair, and there is no reaction, that basically says to Putin, you know what, if you need to kill anyone here, nothing's going to happen. And so far, nothing kind of has happened. I mean, expelling 23 diplomats is nothing. They're going to have to add on, if the British government doesn't join the U.S. in sanctioning the same set of individuals, that's just a total victory for Putin.
What about if they get sanctioned the owner of Chelsea Football Club?
Well, I mean, he must be just scratching his head, wondering how he avoided it and they got it, and wondering if he's next. And it's very interesting because the person who lost the most money on the stock market wasn't Deripaska or Vekselberg. It was Vladimir Patanin, who was not sanctioned. The value of his company went down in dollar terms to him more than other people. And so everybody is scared. The markets are pricing in bad things to come. And probably bad things will come.
I think it's worth reminding everybody, as I've heard you do before, that you don't have anything against the Russian people, do you? I mean,
No.
All your staff, you came back to London with you, you've continued to employ them, you're married to a Russian. So you must hold out some hope for them in the long run.
Well, I believe that 145 million Russian people are living in an occupied country, which is occupied by a criminal organization, and who are sucking out all the resources for themselves at the expense of everybody. And I don't actually hold out much hope because I think that this thing could go on for a long time. But it doesn't mean I don't love Russia or have great affection for the Russian people. My beef is not with the Russians, it's with Putin and his criminal organization.